Radio Derb is on the air. Welcome, listeners. This is your eternally genial host, John Derbyshire, with the news of the hour. Well, I survived a family Christmas with two teenagers, just barely. Santa brought me some liquor, some candy, some books, and three, count them, three jigsaw puzzles. Good old Santa. I hope you all had a jolly time out there in Radioland, and I hope you're all fortifying yourselves for what promises to be a challenging year. Here's the show.
Let's go on with the show.
President-elect Obama has pretty much filled out his cabinet by now. His latest pick, Hilda Solis as Labour Secretary. Who's she? Well, let's take a look at who likes her. This guy likes her. Roberto Lovato, a writer for La Prensa of San Diego. Quote from him. This is especially welcome news to labour and immigrant rights groups who have constituted Solis's primary base in her rise to national prominence. Oh, boy. Continuing quote, the daughter of Mexican and Nicaraguan immigrant labourers, Solis brings the most solid progressive credentials of any member of the Obama cabinet, including Obama himself. Whoa, she's more progressive than Obama, who had the most liberal voting record in the U.S. Senate? Oh, dear. Continue quote, she has won abundant praise and wide support because of her positions on labour rights, immigration issues, environmental protection, and women's rights, to name a few. Oh, I think you named enough there, Mr. Lovato. Continue quote, her appointment reflects the growing power and influence of the labour and immigrant struggles of Southern California and across the country. End quote. Mr. Lovato goes on to praise Mrs. Solis for, quote, the struggles against Proposition 187 in California. Now, Proposition 187 was the 1994 ballot initiative to prohibit illegal immigrants from using social services and health care and public education in California. So, apparently, our new Secretary of Labor designate thinks that illegal immigrants should be able to use public services funded by taxes on working citizens. And this helps American workers. How? Perhaps we should just rename the Department of Labour the Department of Illegal Labour. Here's someone else who likes Mrs. Solis. This is an editorialist for the New York Times. He praises Mrs. Solis and then he goes on to say, the first and biggest test of Mr. Obama's commitment to labour will be his decision on whether or not to push the Employee Free Choice Act, which would make it easier than it has been for workers to form unions. The measure is vital legislation and should not be postponed. The real issue is whether enhanced unionising would worsen the recession, and there is no evidence that it would. End quote. So now, wait a minute there. The whole problem with the big three automakers has been the extravagant benefits won by the UAW. And the Times is saying that we need more of that kind of thing? And Mrs. Solis is just the person to give it to us? When she's not agitating for the right of illegal immigrants to push low-paid Americans out of jobs. Oh, this is going to be a great administration for American workers. One half will be encouraged to price themselves out of the labour market, as the UAW has done, and the other half will be shoved aside to make room for illegal immigrants. Crisis in the Middle East. Well, when isn't there some kind of crisis in the Middle East? Here we have Hamas, the elected government of the Gaza Strip, lobbing missiles at random into Israeli towns, and Israel answering with air raids on Hamas buildings. The Arabs complain that civilians are getting killed, and I'm sure they are. But what do they think happens when they drop a half dozen missiles on an Israeli town? Hamas deliberately kills civilians. Israel accidentally kills civilians, and it only does that because Hamas uses civilians as human shields. Who should I be sympathizing with here? Looks like a no-brainer to me. Gaza has a location great for trade and a lovely climate. The inhabitants might have made something of the place. Instead, they elected a bunch of crazy Islamists who want nothing but trouble. Well, they wanted trouble, they got it. What did they expect? Now all the Euro-weenies are howling about the wickedness of the Israelis. What do they expect the Israelis to do when missiles are dropping on their heads? For crying out loud, Israel withdrew from Gaza 2 years ago, pulled out all their settlements, and handed it all over to the Arabs, who, of course, immediately smashed up everything the Israelis had built and then started plotting the next round of terror attacks on Israeli civilians. Now all the muckety-mucks of international peace, harmony and goodwill are telling Israel that they have to pull their settlements out from the West Bank and withdraw from there. Seeing the result of having withdrawn from Gaza, why would Israel withdraw from the West Bank? If appeasing the Arabs gets you nothing but mayhem, why appease them? Here's my own modest suggestion to the Arabs. Show the world that you're capable of building something other than militarized welfare slums ruled by gangsters and lunatics. Then maybe you'll get some sympathy from civilized people. Until then, sorry guys, I'm cheering on the Israelis. One of Russia's biggest TV stations has been running a poll to see who the greatest Russians were. More than 50 million people have voted by phone, internet, or text message. Top of the poll was Alexander Nevsky, a 13th century prince who fought off various Swedish and German attempts at invasion. Second came Peter Stolypin, a reforming prime minister under the last Tsar. He was assassinated in the Kiev Opera House in 1911. The third greatest Russian was, guess who? Uncle Joe Stalin. Actually, Stalin was riding high at number one in the poll for a while, until the organizers appealed to people to vote for someone else. You'd think, wouldn't you, that a dictator who terrorized his country, shipped 25 million of his own citizens off to execution chambers or slave labor camps, starved millions more to death in deliberate famines, and was best buddies with Adolf Hitler, until Hitler turned on him, you'd think he would be vilified and hated. No, the Russians love old Uncle Joe, or at least an awful lot of them do. That would include current Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who is heading up a campaign to rehabilitate Stalin. New school history books have been produced and distributed, telling Russian kids that Stalin acted, quote, entirely rationally to build up his country. And earlier this month, Putin's secret police raided the offices of Memorial. That's a citizens' organization that has been working for 20 years to build up a database of all those who suffered and died under the communist terror. The goons took away Memorial's entire digital archive. A huge blow to our organization, says the director. So I guess I'm not the only one who isn't very diligent about backing up my computer files. And while I sympathize with those people at Memorial, I must say, given that Russia still owns thousands of nuclear warheads, I would selfishly vote for a Russia under tight dictatorial control rather than an unstable Russia. The risk of instability is real. Russia's taking a big hit from the global economic crisis and the low price of oil. Matter of fact, they're doing bailouts to help their economy. 10 trillion rubles so far, with 300 Russian companies getting assistance. If it keeps Russia stable, I'm fine with it. January 1st is the 50th anniversary of the flight of Fulgencio Batista from Cuba, leading soon after to the beginning of Fidel Castro's regime. Batista was a gangster and a thief, no doubt about it, but his rule wasn't anything like as bad as what followed. He was a real man of the people, a half-caste whose father was a sugarcane worker, as compared with Castro, who was the son of a millionaire landowner from Spain. To be sure, Batista allowed the mob to run casinos in Havana, making the place a sort of Caribbean Las Vegas, but he never engaged in the totalitarian mass killings of the Castro regime, or the complete annihilation of civic freedoms, or the glorification of Soviet communism. He tried his best to keep the Cuban constitution alive, in fact. While Castro murdered his political opponents out of hand, Batista actually released Fidel Castro from prison after less than 2 years, as a conciliatory gesture to his opponents. Well, that worked out well, didn't it? I'd prefer not to live under a dictatorship, but if I had to choose between living under Batista or living under Castro, I wouldn't hesitate for a second. Batista's government was far better. Well, Cuba's had 50 years of communism. The average wage is $25 a month. The country, which could easily be self-sufficient in food, spends $2 billion a year importing food. And your choice of an automobile in Cuba is between a 1965 Russian Lada or a 1957 Buick. And of course, innumerable people have been murdered, tortured, driven into exile, or sent to labour camps for having the wrong opinions. What a tragedy. Now Cubans are waiting to see if Barack Obama will lift the US embargo. I'd say lift it when Fidel Castro dies, but not before. Why should we do that murdering old bastard any favours? The Archbishop of Canterbury can always be depended on to add to the world's stock of harmless amusement. Here he was, writing in the Daily Telegraph just before Christmas, warning that governments shouldn't pursue, quote, dogmatic solutions to the financial crisis at the risk of, quote, the most vulnerable. Who are the most vulnerable? Quote, the pensioner whose savings have disappeared, the laid-off employee, the hopeful young executive, the helpless producer of goods in some third-world environment where prices are determined thousands of miles away. End quote. And why would it be wrong for our governments to expose these vulnerable people to risk? Because, quote, that's what the Nazis did. Are you getting this? If our governments don't reimburse us for investments that have gone south, and keep us in our jobs, however unproductive, and shovel our national wealth into third world countries, however corrupt, then pretty soon they'll be invading Poland and hustling us off to gas chambers. We must not lose our moral compass, declares the Archbishop. Well, never mind the moral compass, how about losing our marbles?
Psycho dad, psycho dad.
Well, I hate to end the year on an upbeat note. I wouldn't want Radio Derb listeners to think that I was going all touchy-feely on them. So here is the worst story from the Christmas season. In fact, one of the worst stories of the year. This is the psycho dad over there in Los Angeles. Technically a psycho stepdad, I think. Bruce Jeffrey Pardo, recently divorced and out of a job since July, went to his ex-wife's parents' home on Christmas Eve wearing a Santa outfit. The family was having a party. The house was full of the ex-wife's relatives. Pardo opened fire on them, killing 9 and severely wounding a couple more, including a little 8-year-old girl whom he shot in the face. Then he torched the place with a homemade flamethrower he'd brought along for the purpose. Unfortunately for Pardo, your homemade flamethrower needs very careful handling. He burned himself badly. Then he drove off in great pain and shot himself. His original plan, apparently, had been to flee to Canada. Police found the airline tickets on his body. The thing that sends shivers up the spine here, apart from the beastly cruelty of the deed itself, is that Pardo didn't fit the crazy killer profile at all. He wasn't a twitching misfit loner with a record of antisocial misdemeanors. He seems, in fact, to have been something of a boulevardier. The LA Times quoted Rachelle Maxheimer, a former roommate, whatever that means, saying that Pardo was a ladies' man, quote, preferring younger women and dating several at once, end quote. Pardo kept his lawn neat and walked his dog. He was a guy who loved his cars, too. He had a Hummer and a Miata. He was a big, good-looking man, gentle and kind, according to everyone, fond of kids, and an usher at his local church. This whole horror was about as random as anything can be. Criminals kill for money. Tyrants kill for power. Jeffrey Pardo killed from sheer anger, with nothing to hope for from the act, and he left 10 children orphaned. There isn't any political point here, or any lesson to be learned, or any program of action indicated. There's no moral to be drawn, except the oldest one of all, which is that the heart has some very dark places, not necessarily visible from the outside. I hope the murdered dead will rest in peace. I hope the orphans will find loving homes. And I hope I make it to the end of the road without ever coming face to face with what those poor people encountered in Los Angeles this Christmas Eve. Here's the traditional miscellany of short items to see us out of 2008. Item: congratulations to Michelle Duggar of Arkansas on the birth of her 18th child. I grew up listening to my mother's stories about her 12 siblings and what a warm and busy family they were, so I got an early predilection for big families. Of course, that was then, and this is now. My uncles left school at 14 and started bringing money home. Nowadays, with college fees and medical insurance, and nobody earning much of anything until their mid-20s, it's a brave couple who go for a dozen kids or more. Braver than the Derbs, for sure. I'm kind of glad somebody's doing it, though. Welcome to the world, Jordan Grace Duggar. Item: Mexican beauty queen Laura Zuniga was crowned Miss Hispanic America earlier this year. Now it turns out that the lovely Miss Zuniga was a gangster's moll. The shapely lady was busted, if you'll pardon the expression, in the Mexican town of Guadalajara just before Christmas, riding in an SUV with her boyfriend, who is a drug smuggler, alongside $53,000 in bills and a big stash of firearms. The Mexican tabloids are now referring to the lady as Miss Narco. Well, if the crown fits, wear it, Laura. The really surprising thing here, given Mexico's general condition of degenerate corruption, is that any policeman could be found who were willing to arrest these crooks. Item, a friend of mine upstate makes the following points about Illinois Governor Blagojevich. Long quote. Governor Blagojevich says he is fighting for the disenfranchised. What a strange constituency group for a politician to cater to. It is reasonable for a politician to be solicitous of those who are too young to vote. Ages minus 3/4 to 17, even though they can't yet return the favour by voting for him. But Governor Blagojevich is fighting not for the unenfranchised, but for the disenfranchised. That is, for those people who used to be able to vote, but who no longer can. Who are these people? Not even people who go insane are deprived of the right to vote. To become disenfranchised, you have to actually do something seriously wrong. As far as I know, in most states, including Illinois, the only people who ever get disenfranchised are those who are convicted of a felony. Prisoners and former prisoners. These are the people that Governor Blagojevich is fighting for. End of long quote. I think that's well said. And not only is Blagojevich fighting for these people, he seems to be doing his best to join them. Item, over in Missouri, the whole ugly business of racial preferences is coming under renewed assault from the Missouri Civil Rights Initiative. The Missouri Secretary of State has approved a ballot initiative for the 2010 elections, so the initiative's supporters have a year and a half to gather signatures and to fight off the concentrated challenges from the legal, political, educational, and commercial establishments of the state, all of whom are determined to keep race preferences. You can add the media to that list, too. Here's a sentence from a December 24th report in the newspaper St. Louis American, explaining the meaning of affirmative action. Quote, by definition, affirmative action was developed to ensure that applicants were treated equally without regard to race, colour, religion, sex, or national origin. End quote. You see, affirmative action is just simple colourblind fairness. No preferences at all. No quotas, no set-asides. Everybody treated equally on their qualifications. Nobody here but us chickens. Item. We haven't heard from little Squinty for a while. What's he been up to? Well, the Poison Dwarf of Tehran appeared on British TV December 25th to deliver a Christmas message. Quote, if Christ were on earth today, undoubtedly he would hoist the banner of justice and love for humanity to oppose warmongers, occupiers, terrorists, and bullies the world over. End quote. And then he predicted that Christ would return with, quote, one of the children of the revered messenger of Islam, and will lead the world to love, brotherhood, and justice. End quote. Isn't that nice? Then the mad midget stuck a banana in each ear and hung upside down by his feet from a studio ceiling fixture, while emitting a high-pitched ululating noise. Merry Christmas, Squinty. Good to know that the next generation of nuclear-armed nations will be in good, responsible hands. Item. Over in the city of Malmö, Sweden, I think that's probably Malmö, Sweden, the youth of the city celebrated Christmas in their own interesting way, by staging riots. If you go to YouTube and enter Malmö riots, or Malmö riots, you will get a good picture. The police were out in convoys of heavily armed vehicles, facing barrages of rocks and Molotov cocktails. The youths set fire to a school, and there was widespread looting. Gosh, those Swedish youths are really unruly, aren't they? Perhaps they'd eaten too many meatballs or watched too many old Liv Ullmann movies. At any rate, you can be sure that these riots are nothing whatever to do with the fact that Sweden has some of the world's loosest laws on immigration and asylum, or that Malmö's population is one quarter Muslim immigrants from the Middle East, or that 90% of these Muslim immigrants are unemployed. The riots have nothing to do with any of that, nothing at all, and it would be a gross violation of multicultural protocols to suggest otherwise. These were just youths, you understand, just Swedish youths. It was probably just Christmas high spirits. Or perhaps, who knows, perhaps they were celebrating diversity. Item, for goodness sake, can we get this stupid Caroline Kennedy thing over with? She's obviously the right person for the job. She's a Kennedy, isn't she? People are saying that she's not qualified. What does that mean? You have to take some kind of exam before you become a US senator? I never heard of that. I wouldn't want it either. The smarter our Congress critters are, the more ways they'll think up to fleece us and wreck our country. Caroline Kennedy doesn't drool or pick her nose in public. She doesn't fall down when she tries to walk. She's stinking rich, so she doesn't need the money that lobbyists will try to stuff into her pocketbook. I think she'd make a fine senator. What's the problem here? Item. If it's real Christmas cheer you want, go to China. Some friends of mine just came back from Shanghai. They said that every store in the city has a Christmas tree, and the big stores have several. Santa Claus, that's the round-eye name for Shangdan Laoren, of course, Santa Claus is everywhere. In fact, according to BBC News, the biggest Santa Claus ever made is on display at the Ice Festival in the far northern Chinese city of Harbin. This Santa is 525 feet long. So there you are. While we diversity-whipped, multi-culti foreign devils are very carefully wishing happy holidays to each other and admiring our neighbours' menorahs, Kwanzaa bushes, Eid al-Fitr outfits and Wiccan solstice decorations, over in the People's Republic, they're just enjoying a Merry Christmas. Funny old world, isn't it? That's it, folks. Another year goes swirling down the plug hole. Not much worth remembering there. A dictatorship Olympics, a liberal multiculturalist elected president, markets crashing all over, a couple of small wars, an earthquake, a psycho Santa Claus, and some guy threw his shoes at our president. Don't blame me. None of it was my fault. I just report the stuff. Let's put it all behind us. Let's celebrate the new year with friends and hope for better times to come. Oh, before I let Robert Burns loose on you, I'll just remind you that it's a special Burns Night coming up on January 25th, the 250th anniversary of the poet's birth. So, get yourself a haggis, there's plenty of suppliers on the internet, and some neeps and tatties and a bottle or two of the golden stuff, and celebrate Burns Night in proper style. Hire a piper, if you can find one. Here's Peter Dawson. Happy New Year, everybody. Good old
und never brucht dem ein, should old acquaintance be forgot and days all lang syne. For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for.